This is a download from the BBC. For full terms and conditions, visit bbc.co.uk/radio3.
The Irish National Anthem sings of guns. Towards its powerful musical crescendo, in Gaelic, it exhorts us to rally this night at the dangerous gap amid the gun screech, Le Gunny Screech, to fulfil our national destiny by fighting for freedom. Of arms and the man, in Ireland we still sing. These words to the national anthem were written by Padraig Carney in 1907. His reference to guns and fighting at first was abstract, general, but it was about to take on a much more real and tangible form when Carney, along with many other Irish nationalists, took part in the gun running of 900 Mauser rifles into Ireland at Howth near Dublin at the end of July 1914. The guns had been bought in Germany and then smuggled to Ireland on the yacht of the then internationally famous writer Erskine Childers, whose best-known novel, The Riddle of the Sands, was ironically a warning fantasy about a German plot to invade the United Kingdom. Now, just days before actual war would break out between Britain and Germany, Childers was enacting his own swashbuckling invasion of a home beach with crates of German guns. Born in London, of part Irish heritage, disillusioned with British imperialism after a stint serving in the Boer War, Childers had found his cause. The Howth gun running, as it became known, marked the beginning of the 20th century cult of the gun in Irish nationalism. The intention was that the Howth guns would be used should the ongoing political campaign for Ireland to obtain home rule, devolved government for Ireland within the United Kingdom, end in violence between those who supported home rule, like Carney and Childers, and those who opposed it, Ireland's unionists. The unionists already had their guns. In April 1914, the Ulster Unionist Militia, the Ulster Volunteer Force, had audaciously smuggled 25,000 German, Italian and Austrian rifles into the north at Larne. The British authorities had turned a blind eye, their complicity encouraging the nationalist home rulers to believe that they too could arm themselves with German weaponry. The Larne arms were landed at night and swiftly hidden. In contrast, the arrival of the Howth guns in broad daylight had an almost public pageantry. Crowds of observers, like the nationalist aristocrat Cheska Trench, came out to watch. For her, the gun landing appeared romantic, epic. I tried to conceal my thrills. The white yacht was there, but it was too far off to see well what they were doing. At last they began to march towards us. I thought they had the guns, but wasn't sure. They came nearer and we saw. Then we cheered and cheered and cheered and waved anything we had and cheered again. To see and hear that was the best thing that ever happened to me in my life. The gun smuggling was also recorded in photographs. Perhaps the most iconic image is of Erskine Childers' wife Molly, who accompanied him on his journey to Germany to collect the weapons, and their friend and travel companion Mary Spring Rice on board the yacht with a crate of the German Mausers. Two Edwardian upper-class ladies in long skirts, their hair coiffed high, delicate collars, each holding a Mauser rifle. Spring Rice was apparently somewhat old maidish and schoolmarmish, a quiet mouse of a girl who occasionally wore brown stockings with an elaborate darn. She seems an incongruous figure to cradle a Mauser gun in 1914. But that year, the most unlikely figures were buying and cradling guns. Even a university professor and MP, Tom Kettle, accepted to go to Belgium to see if he too could buy guns for Nationalist Ireland. The Howth gun landing took place in an atmosphere of fate and excitement. This was a week before the outbreak of the First World War, which would brutally reveal that the Edwardian romance with rifles was about to end in the horrors of the Western Front. Guns were still exciting, chivalric, beautiful, not just to Irish nationalists, but all across a generation of young Europeans who were enthralled to their power, from the Futurist movement in Italy to the anarchist intellectuals of France. Patrick Pearse, the romantic Irish nationalist and devout Catholic, could write, that the only thing more ridiculous than an Ulsterman with a rifle is a nationalist without one. But the Unionists were savvier rifle purchasers. Unlike the Unionist guns, the Hoth rifles were an old model that dated from 1871, developed by Paul and William Mauser of the Mauser Company, after issues with weaponry during the Franco-Prussian War had led the new German Empire to improve its army stock. The 71 Mauser was mass-produced at Spandau Arsenal. With Europe on the brink of the First World War, Irish nationalists had been buying up weapons in Germany, but the Mauser guns they had been able to purchase were clearly from the back catalogue. Germany's more up-to-date guns were going to be in need elsewhere as war with the Entente loomed. Technically, the 1871 Mauser was obsolete by 1914. It had been updated several times in the 1880s. But the 71 rifle could still kill, firing a larger bullet than the British Lee Enfield. It was a single-shot, bolt-action rifle that used black powder cartridges. Its revolutionary innovation in 1871 was its wing-type safety lever. As Larjoy from the National Museum of Ireland points out, the 71 Mauser also had ferocious recoil, as one young rebel, Tom Walsh, soon learned. In the excitement, I did not heed the lectures and did not hold the gun correctly. The result was that the first time I fired it, the butt hit me under the chin and knocked me out. That sunny Sunday morning at Hoth ultimately marked the moment when Ireland's naive, new abstract romance with the gun and the truth of its bloody violent potential first collided. As the militia volunteers unloaded the guns at Hoth, all seemed well. They were not intercepted and marched freely back into Dublin. En route, they were met by more onlookers, exhilarated by the guns' arrival, who cheered these exciting new weapons. The guns were quickly hidden, but the gathered crowds jeered and harassed British troops sent to intercept the weaponry as it was brought into the city. A unit of the King's Own Scottish Borderers, some injured from projectiles thrown by the crowds, cracked under the pressure and opened fire in response, killing three bystanders, including a 50-year-old woman, and wounding 37. Another man died later from his wounds. It became known as the Bachelor's Walk Massacre, after the name of the street where it took place. Remember Bachelor's Walk quickly became a rallying cry for radical nationalism. The 71 Mauser, likewise, soon became known in Ireland as the Hoth Mauser. It was this gun, brought in 1914 and hidden, that would ultimately resurface on the streets of Dublin as the rifle used by nationalist rebels in the 1916 Easter Rising, the violent insurrection against British rule in Ireland that radicalised Ireland onto the path towards full independence. Childers, however, never got to use the guns he had imported out of romantic nationalist ideals. He chose, with the sudden outbreak of war in Europe, to moderate his nationalism and served in the British force in the First World War. Ironically, for the man who so iconically imported the most symbolic guns of the Irish 20th century, a gun would later be his own undoing. Several years later, during the Irish Civil War, as a young, new Irish Free State frantically tried to control access to weapons in the population, Childers was executed by the government for having in his home a small pistol. The pistol had apparently been a personal gift from Michael Collins, the recently assassinated, revered hero of the Free State, and of Childers' executioners. But this link with Collins did not save Childers. This was a war when former comrades turned against each other. A state minister, Kevin O'Higgins, would execute his own best man from his wedding. In yet another irony of Irish history, the Free State government that executed Childers, the importer of the Hoth guns, would itself import British guns to fight its cause in the Irish Civil War. It used British heavy artillery against the forecourts in Dublin, the site of a key Civil War battle. Childers' legacy, however, lived on, and his son would later become President of Ireland. The 1914 Hoth gun running continues to be remembered through the soft-focused lens of Edwardian nostalgia, but it is not difficult to see certain continuities of strategy with more modern times. such as the IRA of the 1970s, smuggling AR-15 and AR-18 Armalite rifles into Northern Ireland. The rifle was here again, central to Irish history, with the Armalite lending its name to one of the most famous Sinn Féin slogans, the Armalite and the Ballot Box, a term coined from a speech by Danny Morrison, Sinn Féin organiser and strategist, in 1981. The Armalite and the Ballot Box described the policy of Sinn Féin to contest elections in Northern Ireland, while the IRA also continued to wage its armed campaign, what Morrison described as taking power in Ireland with a ballot paper in this hand and an Armalite in the other. The slogan is more famous than the rifle make itself, which was tellingly, chillingly, also known colloquially as the Widowmaker. Guns have never truly gone away in Ireland since Howth and Larne. Indeed, some of the guns landed in 1914 remained in place, hidden until recent times. Unionist guns from the Larne gun running turned up in routine British Army searches after 1969. Munitions from the Easter Rising have also surfaced. In 2011, renovations on a Dublin home turned up a stash of 1916 Easter Rising grenades in a back kitchen. The family who had once lived there, the Norgroves, had taken part in the Rising. The Norgrove parents, with their 9 children, for decades lived above a domestic arsenal. There can be little better illustration of the domestication of Ireland's violent political history. In 1923, at the end of the bitter Irish Civil War, the leader of the rebels who were fighting the new Free State government, Frank Aiken, ultimately directed that his men should surrender and dump arms. In practice, these guns were stashed away in hides or buried. They were embedded in the Irish landscape, a metaphor for the deep connection between the gun and Irish politics that the Howth and Larne gun runnings established so dramatically. Irish writers and artists have long recognised this. Well might Sean O'Casey, in the 1920s, aptly entitle one of his most famous plays on Irish history, In the Shadow of a Gunman. For the poet Seamus Heaney, in his poem Digging, the pen is a direct substitute for the danger and shocking presence of the gun. Between my finger and my thumb, the squat pen rests, snug as a gun. To dig up the past in 20th century Ireland, to write it, is to encounter the hidden gun. Indeed, by the era of the Northern Irish Troubles, the gun does not even need to be explicitly described for it to be present in Irish art, as in the case of Paul Muldoon's poem Ireland. Ireland, the Volkswagen parked in the gap, but gently ticking over. You wonder if it's lovers, and not men hurrying back across 2 fields and a river. We all know what the unspoken alternative is that haunts this poem. Men hurrying back, men crossing the invisible border that runs through the countryside. Armed men hastening to the car in the gap. The gap that the Irish national anthem sings of, where guns lurk still.